Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Mark Bittman has made his career thinking and writing about food, what's good for us, what's good for the planet, what's an easy and delicious way to cook a meal. Now he's taken on the world of baking, sweet, savory, decadent, vegan, gluten-free. And he's, of course, making it simple, we hope. This hour On Point, Mark Bittman bakes everything. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your great baking question, insight for Mark Bittman? Do you still bake? Can your health, your waistline afford it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Fishkill, New York is Mark Bittman, former longtime food writer and food politics explorer for the New York Times. Author of over 20 books and cookbooks, he's out with a new one, How to Bake Everything, Simple Recipes for the Best Baking. You can find recipes from it at our website, onpointradio.org. Mark Bittman, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hey, Tom. Nice to talk to you again.
There's so much we want to dive into here. We have one of my producer, Sarah Platt, has baked from your book, and I've got it in the studio, and it smells like heaven in here.
Well, good.
Yeah, we'll turn to that. I want to just catch up with you for a second here. First, though, the last we heard, you were at the New York Times with your longtime column, making waves all over the place, really helping everybody think about what's going on with food and food politics. And then you were gone and off to a startup, a kind of a vegan meal kit company, the Purple Carrot. And I thought you'd gone off to be an entrepreneur forever in California or something. What happened? What are you doing now, Mark?
I'm sitting here talking to you.
Well, that's simple, but.
Well, I left the Times for a number of reasons, but primarily I think it was the wear and tear of weekly deadlines for over 30 years. And
tell me about nothing. Mine are daily. Tell me. Yes, yes.
Okay, well.
Okay.
Sometimes I had seven a week.
Yes,
that's true.
Yeah.
I felt, as I said in my last column, I felt that I was at sort of had hit a wall and had said what I wanted to say, and I felt that whatever impact I was going to have in that world, I'd had. You know, needless to say, a year later, as things go, I feel somewhat differently. I'm going to get back into writing.
Ah, good.
But it was just time for a change, The meal kit, the Purple Carrot thing, was interesting for a while. I left in February, and since then I've been really trying to regroup, think about a couple of big projects, finish the baking book, you know, which took a bunch of time, obviously.
Yep, it's huge.
And think about what's next. So
is the dot-com world going to change the way we eat? You've dipped your toe in it now. I mean, you were part owner of the outfit. Is it going to come in and sort of make us all wise and wily about how to cook and cook well and eat well and be healthier, save the planet?
I hope that it has a positive impact. To go to the extremes that you're saying, I mean, I know you're being playful, but
yeah.
No is the short answer. But that doesn't mean it can't have a positive impact. But to date, I don't think that, I get interviewed quite often about food technology and how the tech world is changing food and so on. And I don't see it to date. I don't see much has happened. Meal kits are interesting, and that's why I joined Purple Carrot, and especially because it was vegan, and I think it's important for people to eat more vegetables. I'm sure we'll get into that. But that alone, no single thing is going to change the way we eat. You know, many, many things have to change.
Let's look at baking. I mean, you're all over baking here. It's an enormous, wonderful. I dipped into it last night and got very, very hungry reading. You've got all the cakes and cookies and then, you know, your overnight French toast and your cheese blintzes and then what, streusel topping in Liberian rice bread and Mexican chocolate tofu pudding. You stretch the meaning of baking very, very widely to my mind here, but I get it. It's delicious. It's sweet and it's savory. I did find myself wondering, though, is baking still something that you're supporting? I think of baking as being an awful lot of white flour and white sugar and big waistlines, all things you've sort of pushed against.
Well, we could just say that I'm a hypocrite and let it go at that, but I think
it's delicious. We all want to eat it, and it's a great cultural tradition and all the rest, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean, and we had many, many discussions about what baking was and what this book should look like and so on. You know, the book is a result of people have asked me to do a baking book for years, and I do think that baking is a subset of cooking, and many people are intimidated by baking, and I thought that bringing my approach, the how to cook everything approach to it would help fix that. And you know, as you've already mentioned, there's a lot of savory. I think probably 25 to 35% of the book, I have to get a count on this, is actually savory food. So it's not the kind of sweet stuff you're talking about. But we do need indulgences. We need to understand their indulgences, or maybe whether we need them or not, we want them. But we need to understand what an indulgence is, and we need to understand that there's high quality baked goods and lousy baked goods, and most of what we eat on a daily basis is mass produced baked goods of the lowest possible quality. That's not what's in this book. So
I
think, you know, if we look at, we want a treat, we want an indulgence, we want to celebrate something, we want a communal event, we want to make a gift for somebody, very often that is sweet food, and I think that's a fine thing as long as it's kept, you know, within limits. I feel, you know, in a way you would be asking me the same kind of question if I had written a book called How to Cook Meat or something. You'd say, well, you're anti-meat. And, you know, the answer is I'm anti almost everything in unlimited quantities except for foods from the plant kingdom, which, you know, as I've expressed many times, we need to be eating more of.
What's the state of baking these days, generally? I mean, you're talking about commercial baking of the lowest possible order. On the other hand, many people have turned to their kitchens and to their ovens, sometimes as a kind of refuge from some of the chaos in the world, and lots of people love to really become expert in these things. When you look out across the populace these days, to the extent that you can and do, where's our baking skill meter stand? Where's the needle stand?
Well, you know, there isn't a town you'll go to around the country that doesn't now have a good bakery. That is happening all over the place. And I think you're also right in that people find relaxation in baking. As I said before, if we want to do a communal, some kind of celebration, it often involves baked goods if we want to make gifts for somebody and so on. So, I it's impossible for me to say how many people are getting into this. I know that for me, if I'm home for 24 hours or more, I bake bread. And it's just something that I do. And I can't explain why I like it. I've been doing it forever. It's frustrating and rewarding at the same time. The results are never quite what I want them to be, but it's just some kind of meditative routine that really feels good.
I'm right there, and I'm sure a lot of people are as well. Open the door, smell something baking, and you're happy right away. Take us to the very foundation, at least of a lot of this. You talk a lot about a lot of the essentials here. You've got so many kinds of flour that you talk about. I mean, white flour, self-rising flour, non-wheat flours, rye flour, buckwheat, and then you get all the way over into really exotic nut flours and right on around. Where does white flour stand in what you do now, and how widely can you stretch in the traditional sort of body of things that we expect to be baked some of these other flours that you're talking about here, Mark?
You know, white flour is the foundation of baking. I think there's no denying that. I think it's also interesting here in the Northeast and also in the West, especially in California, we're seeing people growing better and better strains of wheat on better and better land with better and better treatment. And as a result, I think we're on the cusp of seeing some really great white flours being made. There are some already, but I think we're going to be seeing them.
For taste, for health, for both? What do you mean by great?
For taste, for sustainability, for, you know, health is a relative term, but we're not going to be seeing vast fields, or we're going to continue to see, of course, vast fields of monocultured wheat of standard varieties, but we're also going to see more and more unusual varieties that produce what we would think of as strong flavored wheat. So I think we're going to see, as we have seen, more and more interesting novelty flours, or whatever we want to call them, alternative flours. I think we're going to see more and more interesting wheat flours. And, you know, we've seen spelt and kamut, which are strains related to wheat, for the last, 10 years or so, have made wider and wider appearances, and they're interesting flours. So, you know, in bread baking, you can really integrate, without making many other changes, you can pretty easily integrate 30 to 50% of whole grain into a bread. In sweet baking, that becomes harder, and that becomes harder and more challenging, but it becomes, I think we're getting used to the tastes of whole grains. We're getting used to flours made with whole grains and stripped less of the bran and germ and so on than white flour is. And I think we'll continue to see baked goods with higher and higher percentages of stronger tasting, more interesting flours.
Going to make them just as tasty and healthy as they can be. Mark Bittman is with us. His big new book is How to Bake Everything, Simple Recipes for the Best Baking. He's been writing about food and food politics and good ways in the kitchen for a long time, and this one's a beauty. I dipped in last night. We've got baked goods on the table. We'll come to them. We want your questions on baking. Are you a Mark Bittman fan, an acolyte? Are you ready to bake with Mark Bittman? Is baking your thing? Do you love it? What's your big baking question or big baking tip? That's Eileen Barton with If I Knew You Were Coming at a Bake the Cake. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Oh, I don't know where you came from, 'cause I don't know where you've been, but it really doesn't matter. Grab a chair and fill your platter and dig, dig, dig right in. If I knew you were coming, I'd have baked the cake, hired a band. Goodness sake, if I knew you were coming, I'd have baked the cake. How'd you do, how'd you do, how'd you do? How'd you do, how'd you do, how'd you do? How'd you do?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Mark Bittman, recipe writer and food politics pundit, about his latest big cookbook, How to Bake Everything. It is a gorgeous book, a lot of recipes across a very, very wide span, right beyond what you might traditionally think of as baking, but it's all there, all the way to ice cream, I'd say, here. He was a New York Times columnist for a long time on this front. Now he's out with his big baking book. Of course, baking makes a lot of people very happy. It smells great in the studio right now. We'll look at some of his recipes. We've got baked up right here. Here's just a little bite from a 1959 Disney movie, Sleeping Beauty. Three fairies, Fauna, Meriwether, Flora, preparing for Aurora's birthday with their magical wands.
I'm going to bake the cake. You?
Oh, she's always wanted to, dear, and this is her last chance.
Well, I'm going to make it 15 layers with pink and blue forget-me-not.
She's never cooked.
Oh, it's simple.
All you do is follow the book.
Lordy, lordy, it's simple. And here from Nora Ephron's Julie and Julia, Julie, played by Amy Adams, is at a rough day, unwinds at home with her husband by making a chocolate cream pie.
You know what I love about cooking?
What's that?
I love that after a day when nothing is sure, and when I say nothing, I mean nothing, you can come home and absolutely know that if you add egg yolks to chocolate and sugar and milk, it will get thick. It's such a comfort.
Ooh, and we're in heaven. You can join us this hour. Are you a Mark Bittman fan, an acolyte? Did you follow his years of thinking and writing about food for the New York Times? Has he made you a healthier, happier person? Have you let baking go over worries about flour and sugar and weight, the waistline? Are you ready to bake with Mark Bittman? Buffy in St. Germain, Wisconsin, you're on with Mark Bittman. Thank you for calling, Buffy.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, or my, I guess my anecdotal evidence is, if he's noticed a trend back to scratch baking. And where people are much more concerned, like, say, maybe my mom's generation was, oh, the mix, oh, the this, oh, it's convenient, you know, a box cake mix, where now if he sees, you know, bakers or just kind of cooking in general going back to, like, more of a locally sourced ingredients and just, you know, kind of keeping it simple but using scratch baking more.
Scratch as in make it from scratch. Mark Bittman, what do you say?
Well, of course, I mean, that's all I'm interested in, and that's, there's nothing in here that's not baking from scratch. I think, you know, one thing that people can benefit from is the thought that if you have a well-stocked pantry for baking, and that includes some things in the freezer and the refrigerator, but mostly things on the pantry shelf, and then you encounter, you know, as the caller's saying, you encounter some local, some great berries, or this time of year, apples, pears, quinces, whatever, you can then create almost anything using those great ingredients with what you have in the pantry. So, you know, I have no use for mixes. I never have. So I hope that's the trend.
I hope it's the trend. And a lot of people diving in and loving that. Of course, the other stuff is easy. A lot of questions for you. People are living their lives and baked things and baking. So just a part of life. Sarah in Charlottesville, Virginia. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hi. So I'm a mom that loves to bake, and I love Mark Bittman. And this weekend in town, there's a pie contest. And so the kids and I are baking pie from scratch. And I was just hoping to get Mark Bittman's best tips for making a great winning pie.
Mark, and at some point, you got to go to the crust, because we got a lot of questions on crust here. G. Welch says, pie crust, speak to me of pie crust, shortening, butter, lard, water, vodka, inquiring minds want to know pies and pie crust, Mark.
You know, I think a contest is a little bit different than normal baking. I'll make a couple of general comments about crusts and then say something about a contest. Mm-hmm. I think the best crusts are half lard, half butter. I've always thought that. And there was a time when, you know, you would say something like that and people would gasp that you would suggest using lard. Fortunately, those days are over. And the days of Crisco and crusts are pretty much over also. So, I think best. 50% lard, 50%
And what does
butter.
That do for you? Do for the pie crust? The lard, the butter?
The lard gives you flakiness and extra tenderness, the butter gives you great flavor. 100% butter is really good also. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a contest, now you're trying to really impress someone, not with the sort of purity of your crust, but something unusual. So if I were to enter a baking contest, mm-hmm. which I probably wouldn't because I'd be afraid to lose, but I think I'd add a little bit of sugar and I'd add some ground almonds because I think you're just looking for something that's striking, and that way you add a kind of unsuspected sweetness, just a little, and an extra bit of crunch in addition to flakiness. And I'm talking about maybe a teaspoon of sugar and a tablespoon of ground almonds, but I think that would make a huge difference.
What about this question that our online listener writes about water or vodka? The whole vodka thing got some currency not long ago. You got your fluid, but then it evaporates away. Do you go there?
I'm going to plead ignorance on this. I don't. There's a level of obsession that, you know, maybe I'll talk philosophically for a second about this book. If I don't want to bother with something, I don't ask my readers, my book buyers, to bother with it either. So there's a level of cooking that most people in this country have not achieved, have not gotten to. And I'd like to encourage people to get to this kind of intermediate, free-flowing, I know how to cook, nothing scares me kind of thing. And I'd like people to avoid the kind of obsessiveness that says, what's the absolute best way to do this? And that's always been my philosophy, is let's do this so it's really, really good. Let's not try to make it the absolute best by being triply obsessive about it. And that's always been my attitude.
And we've got a lot in here to look at. We've got 15 pages on pancakes, 10 varieties of fritters, cabbage strudel, cornfield, chicken, chili, cobbler, Mark Bittman in How to Bake Everything stretches it wide. I've got some of these on the table that have happily been baked for me right here this morning, right out of your recipes. And the very first one, another one of those sort of fundamentals, bread. And this is a no-knead bread. Could you explain that to me? I had some at a restaurant, Juliet, in Somerville, Massachusetts the other night. It was just fantastic. And now here you show up with no-knead, as in K-N-E-A-D, no kneading. what's how's it work, and how do you get a good bread without kneading?
Well, you know, I don't show up with no-knead bread. Modesty aside, I popularized no-knead bread, and it's a great story. A guy named Jim Leahy, who founded and runs Sullivan Street Bakery in New York, called me in 2007 and said, I have this way of making bread that requires no kneading. Are you interested in seeing it? I said, sure am. And I went with a video crew and wrote this story about Jim and his bread and taped it, shot it as well. Actually, in those days, probably were using tape. Shot it as well. And it was number one on the Times most emailed list for weeks.
Well, it's incredible.
And it's been incredibly popular, and that's because it works. And it's really simple. You mix together flour, water, yeast, and salt with a much higher percentage of water than most home-baked bread recipes use, more like what good professionals use. And you let that rest overnight for 12 to 18 hours. And then this is the tricky part. You very carefully shape it into a ball. You let it rest again, and then you bake it in a covered pot, which simulates an oven with steam in it, which most of us don't have. Mm-hmm. And the results are fantastic. And anyone can go online and see that there are thousands and thousands of blog posts about no-knead bread, and people, again, getting way too obsessive, in my opinion, about it. But it is revolutionary is a ridiculous word, but it is a real step forward in home bread baking, and has turned many of us into fanatics.
Totally delicious. Really awesome.
Yeah.
Just awesome. Let's get a call from Georgia, if we may, Mark. Lorette's calling from Columbus, Georgia. Lorette, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. And Mr. Bittman, I look forward to buying your book.
Thank you.
One thing I've struggled with for years is being an Army brat that was stationed in Germany. I miss terribly real bread with real grain and this superior crust that you just can't seem to get over here. I work with a lot of bread, but can't seem to get the crust. I get the grain part. Is there a secret to getting a real crust on a bread?
That is a great question. Boy, I'm just back from Germany not long ago, and the bread was just out of this world. And the crust, Loretta, I agree with you right there. It's hard to get it, to find it. What's the secret, Mark?
Well, I go back to no-knead bread. If you bake a bread in a covered pot that is about the right size for the size of dough ball that you have, and you can make as big or small a dough ball as you can, you will get great crust. I guarantee it. Try that recipe. It's incredible.
But in general, what is it? I mean, not all German bread is no-knead bread. What is the difference, do you know, between what they're doing over there and what we're doing over here that makes the crust so distinctly different?
They're doing bread that's not as good as it was 20 years ago, and we're doing bread that's better than it was 20 years ago, generally speaking. So we're going to meet in the middle somewhere. And as I said before, there are people doing great things with flour, which when you get to the obsessive point of bread making, you need to start thinking about flour. There are increasingly bakeries doing great, great stuff in the United States. But again, for home cooks, it's a different story. You mm-hmm. don't have the ovens. You don't have the – and I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm saying if you're willing to make it a hobby, it can be done. If you want to do it casually, you want to make great bread, this no-knead recipe is the way to go.
We've got regional questions for you as well, or altitude questions. Elizabeth, Colorado. Linda is calling. Linda, you're on with Mark Bittman. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
A big fan, Mr. Bittman.
Thank you, Linda.
I have so many of your books. I cannot wait to get this one.
Great.
I live at 7,000 feet. I also bake gluten-free. I cannot get a yeasted bread to rise in my house. How do you have tips?
You know, I bet that you know more about this than I do. I'm sorry, I don't want to disappoint you, but I could make some things up, I could theorize, but I just don't have the experience of high altitude baking that you have. So I know that it's tricky. I've heard this before. It's not something I've really solved. I'm sorry.
Linda, we're going to have to think of you at 7,000 feet trying to make that work. Good luck to you. Send us your tips if you've got them. A lot of listeners in Colorado. Maggie in York Beach, Maine, other side of the country. Maggie, you're on with Mark.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, Mark, I love your books. I have a house in St. Martin, which is half Dutch, half French. The only cookbook I have in the house is How to Cook Everything. People use it all the time. Flour. I find that particularly pie crusts I've always struggled with. I've been buying the European flour on the French side, no GMOs, growth hormones, that type of thing,
yep.
Much finer milled. And I do the same as you do, maybe a quarter, half lard, half butter, or maybe a little more butter. Always work really cold. Comes out gorgeous. Do you have any feeling about flours, finer milled flours, and particularly things without growth hormones or GMOs? I believe when you eat these things, they make you get the growth hormones. So you grow too.
Oh, watch out.
I have no science behind that.
Okay.
It's my thought.
But a firm belief. We got it. What do you say, Mark?
I think that you're concerned. You're expressing a concern. I hear you. If I were you, I would stick with organic flour. It sounds like that's what you want. I think for most people, standard all-purpose flour really is standard and all-purpose and works pretty well. Oh, and it's impossible for there to be a growth hormone in flour, and there's still no genetically modified strains of wheat commercially available. So neither of those is really, should be a concern.
Mind more at ease there. And what about the fineness of the milling of the flour? Do you pay attention, Mark?
Again, I think we're getting into points that aren't that, you know, that just aren't that important. When a decent flour is called all purpose, it really will work in most cases. I feel like I'm swimming upstream here a little bit because I'm trying to say there's a way to do this that's not that challenging and where you don't have to think too hard.
Mm-hmm.
But people want to think about their baking. Well,
right?
I think we're hearing from people who take baking very, very seriously. Yeah. I want to encourage people who are intimidated by baking to understand that it's quite simple and straightforward, and these are not really issues you need to be concerned with.
Tell me about I've got olive oil cake from your book here. Olive oil is not an oil I would associate normally with cake.
Well, you know, all fat makes things tender. Mm-hmm. Olive oil is obviously a fat and a really good tasting one. That is a surprising recipe because it's among my favorites. It's really delicious and it's quite surprising. Oh, you're eating it.
I'm eating it right now. Lemon glaze.
Lucky
wonderful.
You.
Yes, I'm very lucky. I'm getting a little buzz right straight off of one bite here. And of course, I get the feeling of the oil there, but I don't taste olives. Maybe I do the more I think about it.
I mean, it depends what kind of, you know, it's like any other use of olive oil. If you use
right there behind the lemon, I think there is. I do feel
well,
like,
it's in there.
It's in there.
There's a lot of it in there. There's a cup of it in there. So.
Do people just take that? Have you got to be in Italy to have olive oil cake, or are we going to have that, I don't know, in Minnesota?
We're going to have that in Minnesota. We're already having it in Boston, obviously.
Yes, we are right now. And it is pretty terrific. Do you find people willing to make those kind of substitutions, olive oil for whatever else it might have been, to go for that different flavor, texture?
Well, you know, your little list of some of the recipes that are in How to Bake Everything at the top of the show was kind of the challenge that I set to myself, which was let's not do a baking book that's straight American stuff. Let's do a mm-hmm. baking book that's global in reach and that exposes people to a lot of different things. And obviously, no one's going to make everything, but there is something in here for everyone.
You've got dosas in here right alongside streudel. It's a big, wide swath that Mark Bittman is cutting. The new book is How to Bake Everything. Mark Bittman joins us today from Fishkill, New York. You can join us as well. If you've got a burning baking question for Mark Bittman, Do you need advice on your pie crust, your meringue, the way your cookie crumbles, your blintzes? Do you love baking? Do you fear it? This is, baking, Aztec Two-Step. Enjoy it. I'm going to eat some olive cake here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
You do the baking and I'll do the making. How our lives will rhyme. Yes, you do the baking and I'll do the making.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org number 3030.
Well, when the sunshine brings the birds on the wing, I will sit back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mark Bitton is our guest today. He wrote How to Cook Everything way back when. It's been on many, many people's shelves for a long time since then. Now he's come out with How to Bake Everything, 700 plus recipes here, and with his trademark sort of let's keep it simple and let's keep it kind of flexible, fluid. Have it your way. Find the way you really like it. You can join us this hour. Do you have a burning baking question for Mark Bitton? We've been sampling no-knead bread and olive oil cake. We've got a little more baking on the table. I'm looking forward to it. Mark, lots of questions for you on the gluten-free front, and you address that head-on in this book. But, you know, what about low or no-gluten baking, Jed asks. Many are avoiding gluten as an anti-inflammatory strategy. Lil says, how about gluten-free? I've started out on this, and I want to avoid gums. How do you get a good yeast spread without gluten or gums? I've tried flaxseed, meal, gelatin, agar. They always collapse. Gluten-free, Mark.
You know,
it sounds like an evil genius laugh there.
I didn't bargain for this when I started this project, I have to say. And you know me and yep. Many people know what I'm going to say now. There is a percentage of the population that's really allergic to gluten. And for those people, this is important. And for everyone else, I think this is a fad. And 5 years from now, we're not going to be talking about it.
That's incredible,
that,
given how widespread the concern is right now. That's what fads are.
I could remind you about, you know, we could talk about many other things that seemed important. Well, cholesterol.
Yes.
Oat bran. Mm. We could talk about many, many things that have come and gone and eating and cooking. And my belief is that for all but a very small percentage of the population, and we're talking about less than 5% and probably less than 3%, this is not something that matters very much. So having said that, I want my book to be useful to everybody, of course. So we have some gluten-free flour mixes in there, and we have many, many recipes that are incidentally or accidentally gluten-free. It's my belief that if you want to avoid gluten, you are not going to eat the kind of bread that you used to eat when you ate bread with wheat flour. And I just think it can't be done. So that's not to say you can't make good food with gluten-free flour. You can make great food with gluten-free flour, but you're not going to be making baguettes that drive you crazy. So I think that's about all I want to say on that subject.
I do have one of your, this is the flourless chocolate almond cookie here on the table.
Right. Incidentally gluten-free, right? It's fabulous.
It's crisp and crunchy and
gooey
fabulous.
Too.
Yeah.
It's fabulous.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Just a tad of goo in there as well. What's the goo come from?
Well, the goo is the sort of combination of ground almonds and egg whites. It's really
it's a meringue cookie in the end, right?
It's close to a meringue macaroon kind of thing.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's a fab. I love that. That is my favorite recipe in the book, I think.
And I'm eating it right now. Flourless chocolate almond cookie. It's got a kind of glaze. What makes the glaze on top?
It just gets shiny from the egg whites.
Wow, all that. And it's pretty too. If that's gluten-free, I'm on board.
Yeah, but that's not
incidental to
it. You know, as I say, there's a lot of recipes in this book that are accidentally or happen to be gluten-free, and there are a lot of recipes in this book that are vegan. And if those are things you're interested in, they're there. To me, those cookies were not about how can I make a gluten-free cookie. Those are awesome cookies.
Awesome cookies. Awesome cookies. Let me take a call so I can eat some more here. Dan in Madison Heights, Michigan. Dan, you're on with Mark Bittman. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm Mark.
Hey, Dan.
I'm a fully glutinous home baker. I've been really getting into the home sourdough and using kind of a wild starter. But my problem has been as I create a nice starter, I feed it whole wheat, and then after about 2 or 2.5 weeks, it starts to turn, and then it kind of dies, and I don't get any leavening power from it.
Oh,
I've tried various methods. One that I found on Breadtopia of adding pineapple juice when starting it helps. You know, citric acid helps with the balance. And I'm just wondering if you have any tips for maintaining a starter for longer than a few weeks so I can bake more bread.
You know, people have maintained starters for over 100 years.
Yeah.
So a few weeks is not something's wrong. So putting aside the odd chance that you live in some place that's hostile to your starter, which I think is not impossible.
What could that mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, conflicting yeasts, or you're nourishing the wrong kinds of yeasts with that flour. Mm-hmm. I think what I would try two things. I would try rye flour instead of wheat, or I might try rye and white in combination, and I would try feeding it more often. And by more often, I mean every second or third day for a while. That shouldn't be necessary, because I know people who can ignore their starters for a month and they're fine after that. But I also don't know what technique you're using. If you say that you're having rising problems, I hope you know that you should really be feeding the starter before you use it in your bread. So that is the day before you want to bake, you should boost the starter with the addition of half a cup or a cup of white or rye flour, again, a combination, and then discard or use some of that starter and use the rest, save the rest. Use some in starting your bread and save the rest.
Dan,
where did you
come up with it in the first place? How'd you get going?
So I watched a documentary on Netflix that really inspired me to start making my own fermented bread. And the first time I just mixed flour and water and kind of waited for the yeast in the air to populate my starter. And then recently my wife bought me a starter from a starter that had been preserved out in San Francisco, and I've been using that. And that is a little bit more hearty, but again, I baked a couple loaves. They turned out great. I've been feeding my starter every day, and yet it's still kind of petered out. So I'm just not sure what's going on.
I'm not either, Dan. Sorry.
Sounds like a pet. maybe get a new pet. I don't know. Dan, thanks for your call. We got so many questions here. Akron, Ohio, Nooper, you're on with Mark Bittman. Thanks for calling, Nooper.
Yes. Hi, Mr. Tom and Mark. I was I bake quite a lot. I come from an Indian background, and we don't eat eggs. So I do a lot of eggless baking. I'm able to make muffins and pies and cupcakes without egg. Like, I use tofu sometimes, I use flax seeds, and all of those work well. But I haven't really figured out what to use for cakes. What can I use for cakes so that they turn out soft and moist, as well as, you know, without using egg? Do you have any idea?
Well, it's tricky, because really eggs do bring that kind of tenderness and richness and loft to cakes. If you've tried tofu, I mean, that would be the first place that I would go, would be tofu. Other than that, you know, nothing off the top of my head that is a general easy substitute for eggs, because it's tricky.
Not that simple, Nooper.
It's not that simple. I mean, tofu is one thing.
Nooper, you're stumping even Mark Bittman. I don't know. Maybe there's another way to go. You get a lot of options in this book apart from big fluffy cakes.
you know, you can try, people try chickpea water, people try agar. There are a lot of things, but it's difficult to get the same kind of, I would say impossible to get the same kind of texture in a real cake without eggs. Sorry.
Yeah. Nooper, good luck to you. Can we talk about cookies for a second? Drop cookies. I mean, you start right off with chocolate chunk, not chocolate chip, I know, but chocolate chunk cookies.
Well, because I want to discourage people from buying chocolate chips and using real chocolate cut up into chunks.
Well, we hear that. You got this wonderful constellation on the facing page of, you know, what it takes to massage cookies in different directions if you want chewy.
Isn't that a cool chart?
It's totally cool. I want to put it on the ceiling or something and just stare up at it at night. Because you've got sort of these nodes. What do you want? You want cakey or chewy and soft or chewy and fudgy or thin and crisp? Walk us through a little bit of that and how you can steer drop cookies in different directions. If I want chewy and soft, what direction do I go?
Well, you know, just to back up a tiny bit, this is really – I have this page dog-eared in my book. I'm, needless to say, carrying a book around with me all the time now.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, I really love it. But it goes really to the heart of what I'm trying to do here, which is to say you don't need a recipe that says here's a chewy and soft chocolate chip cookie, here's a crisp chocolate chip cookie, here's a cakey chocolate chip cookie. They're not that different. You need to, or experienced bakers, experienced cooks, understand that with simple adjustments, you can get any kind of texture out of a cookie that you want to. So you asked about
chewy and soft.
Chewy and soft. I'd raise the oven temperature a little bit, and I'd add an extra egg. And that, you know, I'd take a basic recipe and do something like that. And then you have to say, well, is this chewy and soft enough for me? Do I like this enough? Sometimes you can get textural differences by cooking at a higher temperature for a shorter period of time, a lower temperature for a longer period of time. All of these things have an impact. Less baking powder, more baking powder if you want it cakier, and so on down the line.
I mean, it's a lot of fun just to think you've got a recipe. Now, which way do I want to steer it? And Mark Bittman gives you a lot of guidance here in a kind of cookie texture constellation. The new book is How to Bake Everything. Okay, I want to go chewy and fudgy. What do I do?
You know, brown sugar, substituting brown sugar for white sugar, which essentially means substituting a percentage of molasses for white sugar, because brown sugar is just white sugar with molasses in it, goes a long, long way in that. Again, a little bit more egg, maybe just in the form of a yolk, and shorter baking time, because the longer you cook something, the more it dries out. So an underdone cookie is often what people are looking for, because cookies will dry out and harden a little bit as they cool. So if you remove cookies a little bit before you think they're done, they'll be chewier, they'll be seem richer because they'll be less dry.
Simple as that. Kevin in Hartford, Connecticut, you're on with Mark Bittman. Thank you for calling, Kevin.
Hi, Tom. So my question is really about, we've talked a lot about flour and starches on this episode. What's Mark's take on sugar now that we're seeing that a lot of literature and scientific reports are coming out with sugar really being, you know, the culprit behind a lot of problems?
So glad you asked. I'm known to be not anti-sugar, but anti-excess of sugar, and I think that's reflected here. I am not trying to do low-sugar baking here. I'm trying to do full-flavored, really good, mostly traditional, and a lot of different traditions baking. My feeling, I think, as I said at the top, but I'll reiterate, is that baking is much of this book is about treats, about desserts, and about other kinds of indulgences. Sugar is a part of those recipes. Not necessarily. You can make these things less sweet. You can make them without sugar. But for the most part, when people eat dessert, they're talking about eating something sweet. I think the answer to this is see desserts as a treat. See desserts as something that are occasional, and by that I mean not all the time, and also four occasions, and moderate your sugar intake that way. Sugar, we eat something like 50 times as much sugar, literally, as we did 100 years ago. If we ate only 10 times as much sugar as we did 100 years ago, we'd be cutting our sugar intake by 80%. That's probably about what we need to do.
Let's take it far from sugar then. John in Duxbury, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Mark. So I'm an oyster farmer in Duxbury, and sometimes I get large oysters.
I bet I've had your oysters.
Me too.
Yeah, I bet you have too. Anyway, I just want to know, Mark, your thoughts on baking oysters. I'm trying to self-improve.
Well, I would like to hear what your thoughts are on them also, but my feeling about oysters, and it's I've been saying this for, I don't know, 30 years, you can't improve on a raw oyster. You just cannot. So, and that's especially true of North Atlantic oysters, if you ask me. So, but I'd like to, you've got the daily expertise. I'd like to know what you think.
What do you think, John?
Yeah, so these are oysters that would be large. Sometimes we get large oysters. Mm-hmm. And
what do we call them? Tennis shoes?
Yeah, tennis shoes, jumbos, babies. I mean, a lot of people grill them, roast them, make Rockefeller, things like that. So, since your topic was everything, baking everything, I thought you might have some.
Well, I'm not against roasting oysters, especially if they're big. And my thing is very, very corny, which is I would grill them, take the top shell off, and then put a little butter and Tabasco, butter and Worcestershire kind of thing in there and call them barbecued oysters. But I wouldn't get any more complicated than that.
John, I so appreciate your call from Duxbury, where the oysters are mighty fine. I mean, I don't see that in the index here. I think we finally got you right off the enormous grid of your palette of baked goods, Mark.
Well, great.
We had to go all the way to oysters to get there.
Yeah.
Pretty terrific. Made me want to bake and bake some more and bake widely. The new book is How to Bake Everything, Simple Recipes for the Best Baking. Mark Mittman, it's always great talking with you. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Take care.
You too. Listeners, thanks so much for being with us this hour. We say goodbye here at On Point today to our producer and friend, Catherine Cat Brewer. She's been with us through many, many shows. Producing for this show is no easy task. The deadline, the clock is always ticking. The topics are all over the map, and Kat has gone everywhere with them, including most recently right off to Cleveland for the Republican National Convention. We wish Kat well in all her new endeavors and thank her for all her efforts with us here at On Point. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. Always great to have you right here. Recipes from this, everything I eat this hour, at our website, onpointradio.org. This is On Point.